You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for October 2nd, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about three studies in heart failure: gender differences in post-MI care, new SVT guidelines, and precision medicine. I'm going to start with what I think is the most important study, and that is one on knowledge gaps in heart failure. Now, we know that many problems in medicine stem from communication and knowledge gaps, and it's common in heart failure. And it's a big problem because misunderstanding the disease sets the stage for overtreatment and end of life, which is a terrible problem. Now, a new study released at the Heart Failure Society of America meeting delved into the depths of misunderstanding of caregivers of heart failure patients. These are usually the adult children or spouses. A group of researchers from Penn State did an intriguing study, nifty study, where they looked at the knowledge of caregivers by doing structured interviews of a heart failure patient caregivers. They used the Seattle Heart Failure Model to estimate patient prognosis, and they found that 71% of caregivers didn't really have a good understanding of the disease. The misunderstanding seemed to increase as patients' prognosis worsened, and 76% of caregivers didn't know heart failure was a fatal disease. And a common response was that when patients felt better after diuresis, they didn't have heart failure anymore. Well, anybody who sees patients in the real world isn't surprised by these findings. And I struggle with it. How do we tell our patients they have a life-limiting disease, a fatal disease? I don't want to be morbid, but I think it does a disservice to our patients if we don't explain to them what their expectations and what the trajectory of this disease is. I mean, it's also hard to predict. There are some patients with terrible heart failure, but they do well for a long time. But that's okay. I still think patients need better knowledge so that they can choose care that's right for them. They can do things that they want to do. For instance, if patients don't understand the prognosis of their heart failure, they may be less apt to choose palliative care. And here I'm not talking about hospice care, but palliative care where we enroll a team of people to help us relieve our patient's symptoms. I believe we have to put the heart back in heart failure care, and it has to come from cardiology. We can't expect palliative care to lead on this. Now, the next topic is also a heart failure topic, LCZ-696. I'm going to use that name for the new drug, or I'm going to call it an ARNI inhibitor, but I'm not going to call it valsartan sacubitril, and I don't use brand names. I'm trying not to think in brand names, write brand names, and I wish more doctors would move to not using brand names. But with that commentary aside, we'll get to the Paradigm Heart Failure trial. The Paradigm Heart Failure was a randomized controlled trial of sacubitril versus enalapril in patients with systolic congestive heart failure. The LCZ-696 group did better. The absolute risk reduction was 2.8%, or NNT of 35. But two subgroups arose with questions. One is the drug beneficial at low doses? And that's an important issue because it causes blood pressure and many patients aren't going to get the target. And also, would the drug be beneficial in all ranges of heart failure? And the answer to both those questions, according to a study released at the Heart Failure Society of America meeting, was yes. At 100 or 200 milligrams, same hazard ratios. At all ranges of heart failure, again, similar benefit. And that last finding about heart failure is kind of important because it informs the decision about the next chapter in this drug, and that is its use in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. The Paragon trial is an outcomes trial looking at LCZ-696 in patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. The third heart failure topic is an issue about cerebral lesions and heart failure. Now, we know AFib and heart failure go together, associate. We know that AFib and cognitive decline associate together. So a group of researchers from the ERIC study, A-R-I-C study, a longitudinal cohort study, looked at the presence of cerebral lesions on MRI scan in four groups of patients. No heart failure and no AFib, no heart failure and AFib, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction with and without AFib. And they found, surprisingly, that patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction and no AFib had the highest incidence of cerebral lesions, which is surprising because intuitively you would think that the groups with AFib have more. I mention this because this informs the decision about screening. I worry a little bit about mass screening of AFib because we'll pick up low-risk patients, but if heart failure with preserved ejection fraction patients have that much incidence of cerebral lesions, it makes sense to look for asymptomatic AFib in these patients. So let's change topics and talk about post-MI care and gender differences. A Blue Cross Blue Shield report, 45 million men and women showed that women compared to men were 27% less likely to have PCI, 38% less likely to have CABG, and only 5% less likely to have CATH. So almost the same number of CAS, but fewer interventions. Now some would see this as an injustice, but I do not. First of all, there's definite clinical differences in women versus men. I mean, for instance, women less often than the men have obvious culprit lesion for their MI. But more important than these clinical differences, I believe, is the idea that more intervention is better. I mean, I would propose a situation that it might be that less intervention in women was actually beneficial and that women were the better for it. The point is, we don't know. Next up is topic SVT guidelines, an EP topic. The AHA, ACC, and Heart Rhythm Society got together and formed a 131-page document on new guidelines for the management of SVT. This document comes out, and I'm not sure we need new guidelines for SVT. I mean, what has changed in the last 20 years? And I also worry about too many guidelines. But with those caveats aside, I have to say that this was a nicely done document. It was well written. The language is accessible. The figures were good, and it sort of served as a modern day book chapter. We have a great news story covering the important points. Two notables. One is that the guideline writers mentioned the possibility of using ivabradine in inappropriate sinus tachycardia. This is intriguing. Of course, there's no data, but it's certainly a possibility in a disease that really is difficult to treat. The second, I think, most notable thing about the guidelines is their emphasis on preference-sensitive decisions. I think this is key. I'm often asked to see a patient with SVT and just do ablation. John, fix the problem, cure it, let's get rid of it. I disagree with that kind of thinking. Patients with SVT experience their disease differently. I think they need to know that it's a preference-sensitive decision. They can live with the disease, they can take medicines, or they can have ablation. And I mean, I have some patients who have tons of SVT episodes and won't have ablation. I have others who have one or two episodes and they're willing to take the risk of the ablation and they want it fixed. And the point is that people feel differently about different things and have different risk aversions. So I think that that's a key thing. Patients with SVT need to know it's a preference-sensitive decision. Next up and finally is the issue of precision medicine. Medscape Medical News has a story covering the inaugural event of Medicine 3.0 Precision in Patients. Dr. Eric Tobel, of course, is a leader in this field. He moderated a panel of experts that met in New York. And I love the topic of precision medicine. I see it every day in the office. I have one patient with a disease. They do beautifully with a drug. The very same disease, similar manifestations, and they get adverse effects. Now, you know doctors of the future are going to be able to do better with the precision use of medicine. I also see patients with atrial fibrillation who tell me that their mom or dad died very early of a stroke, and you really think it's highly likely that it's AFib, and there's going to be some genomic markers that are going to be able to better predict the use of anticoagulants. Because, of course, anticoagulants and stroke prevention strategies aren't free. We only want to use them in the patients most at risk for events. And then the other thing I bring up with this Medicine 3.0 meeting was the issue of the engaged patient or the e-patient. And this is a real difference lately. In the last few years, the democracy of the information age has allowed patients to come in with information. They can know about their disease. They can be on patient forums and know about how other people experience their disease. And that puts us in a different role. Instead of just rattling off facts and dictating treatment, we can provide context. And we can use our wisdom that we've got over the years to help patients pick the right thing, make the right decision for them. Now, I'm going to end with a point of caution. One of my biggest concerns about the digital transformation of healthcare is the issue of distinguishing between what is disease and what is normal. I think as we find more things and measure more things and collect more data, we're going to be more apt to make confusion between disease and what is normal. And I already see a lot of disease creation. One of the biggest things I do in my EP clinic is extract fear from the medical decision. So it's going to be a big challenge. I think we'll be able to do it, but I really don't want the healthcare apparatus to create more disease than we already have. So that's it for this week in cardiology. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the heart.org on Medscape.